Have you heard from all your colleges yet?
He wants to know. Only a couple.
What about Finch? Do you think he'll wind up at the same place?
He's trying to be nice, but there's something else there. Maybe the hope that I'll tell him no. Finch and I broke up. I'm not sure what he's going to do. I don't think he knows. He nods and shifts his books to the other hand so that his free hand is now next to mine. Every now and then I feel the brush of his skin. For each step we take, about 5 people call out to him or nod a what's up. Their eyes move past him to me, and I wonder what they see.
Eli Cross is having a party. You should come with me.
I wonder if he remembers that it was his brother's party Eleanor and I were leaving when we had the accident. Then I wonder for a minute what it would be like to be with him again. If a person could ever go back to someone like good, steady Ryan after being with Theodore Finch. No one will ever call Ryan Cross a freak or say mean things about him behind his back. He wears the right clothes and says the right things and is going to the right college after all of this is said and done. When I get to U.S. geography, Finch isn't there, of course, because he's been expelled, and I can't concentrate on anything Mr. Black is saying. Charlie and Brenda haven't heard from Finch in a couple of days, but they don't seem worried because this is how he is. This is what he does. This is the way he's always been. Mr. Black starts calling on us, one by one, down the rows, asking for progress reports on our projects. When he gets to me, I say, Finch isn't here.
I know very well he's not here and that he won't be coming back to school. How are you coming along on your work, Miss Markey?
I think of all the things I could mention. Theodore Finch is living in his closet. I think there's something seriously wrong with him. We haven't been able to wander lately, and we still have 4 or 5 places left on our map. I say, we're learning a lot about this state of ours. I'd never seen much of Indiana before I started, but now I know it really well. Mr. Black seems happy with this, and then he's on to the next person. Under my desk, I text Finch, please let me know you're okay. When I don't hear from him by Tuesday, I ride over to his house. This time a little girl answers the door. She has short, dark hair sliced into a bob and the same blue eyes as Finch and Kate.
You must be Decca, I say,
sounding like one of those grown-ups I hate.
Who are you?
Violet. I'm a friend of your brother's.
Is he here?
She opens the door wider and steps out of the way. Upstairs, I pass the wall of Finches and knock but don't wait for an answer. I push the door open and rush in, and right away I can feel it. No one is here. It's not just that the room is bare. It's that there's a strange dead stillness to the air, as if the room is an empty shell left behind by an animal.
Finch?
My heart is starting to pound. I knock on the closet door, and then I'm standing in the closet, and he's not there. The comforter is gone, along with his guitar and amp, the notebooks of staff paper, the stacks of blank post-its, the jug of water, his laptop, the book I gave him, the license plate, and my picture. The words we wrote are on the walls, and the planets and stars he created are there, but they're dead and still and no longer glowing. I can't do anything but turn around and around, looking for something, anything he might have left to let me know where he's gone. I pull out my phone and call him, but it goes right to voicemail.
Finch, it's me. I'm in your closet, but you're not here. Please call me back. I'm worried. I'm sorry. I love you. but not sorry I love you, because I could never be sorry for that. In his room, I start opening drawers. In his bathroom, I open cabinets. He's left some things behind, but I don't know if this means he's coming back or if these are just things he doesn't want anymore. In the hallway, I pass his school pictures. His eyes follow me as I run down the stairs so fast I nearly fall. My heart is beating so hard and loud that I can't hear anything except the drumming of it, which fills my ears. In the living room, I find Deca staring at the television, and I say, "Is your mom home?"
"Not yet."
"Do you know if she got the messages from my mom?"
"She doesn't check the phone much. Kate probably got them."
"Is Kate here?"
"Not yet."
"Did you find Theo?"
"No, he's not there."
"He does that sometimes."
"Goes away?"
"He'll be back. He always comes back."
That's just his thing. It's what he does. I want to say to her and Charlie and Brenda, to Kate, to his mom, doesn't anyone care why he comes and goes? Have you ever stopped to think that something might be wrong with this?
I go into the kitchen where I check the fridge and center island in case he left a note, because these seem like note-leaving places, and then I open the door to the garage, which is empty. Little Bastard is gone, too. I find Deca again and tell her to let me know if she hears from her brother, and I give her my number. On the street outside, I look up and down for his car, but it's not there either. I pull out my phone. The voicemail picks up again. "Finch, where are you?"
Finch. Day 80. A mother-effing world record. In his poem epilogue, Robert Lowell asked, "Yet why not say what happened?" To answer your question, Mr. Lowell, I'm not sure. Maybe no one can say. All I know is what I wonder. Which of my feelings are real? Which of the me's is me? There is only one me I've ever really liked, and he was good and awake as long as he could be. I couldn't stop the cardinal's death, and this made me feel responsible. In a way, I was, we were, my family and I, because it was our house that was built where his tree used to be, the one he was trying to get back to. But maybe no one could have stopped it. You have been in every way all that anyone could be. If anybody could have saved me, it would have been you. Before he died, Cesare Pavese, believer in the Great Manifesto, wrote, "We do not remember days, we remember moments." I remember running down a road on my way to a nursery of flowers. I remember her smile and her laugh when I was my best self, and she looked at me like I could do no wrong and was whole. I remember how she looked at me the same way, even when I wasn't. I remember her hand in mine, and how that felt, as if something and someone belonged to me.
Violet. The rest of March. The first text comes in on Thursday.
The thing is, they were all perfect days.
As soon as I read it, I call Finch, but he's already turned the phone off, and I go to voicemail. Instead of leaving a message, I text him back. "We're all so worried. I'm worried. My boyfriend is a missing person. Please call me." Hours later, I hear from him again.
"Not missing at all. Found."
I write immediately, Where are you? This time he doesn't answer. My dad is barely speaking to me, but my mom talks with Mrs. Finch, who says Finch has been in touch to let her know he's okay, not to worry, and he promises to check in every week, which implies that he's going to be gone for a while. No need to call in psychiatrists, but thanks so much for the concern. No need to call the police. After all, he does this sometimes. It appears my boyfriend isn't missing. Except that he is. Did he say where he went? As I ask it, I suddenly can see that my mom looks worried and tired, and I try to imagine what would be happening right now if it was me and not Finch who disappeared. My parents would have every cop within 5 states out looking. If he did, she didn't tell me. I don't know what else we can do. If the parents aren't even worried, well, I guess we need to trust that Finch means what he says and that he's all right. But I can hear all the things she isn't saying. If it were my child, I'd be out there myself bringing him home. At school, I'm the only one who seems to notice he's gone. After all, he's just another troublemaker who's been expelled. Our teachers and classmates have already forgotten about him. So everyone acts as if nothing has happened and everything's fine. I go to class and play in an orchestra concert. I hold my first germ meeting, and there are 22 of us, all girls, except for Brianna Boudreau's boyfriend, Adam, and Lizzie Meat's brother, Max. I hear from 2 more colleges, Stanford, which is a no, and UCLA, which is a yes. I pick up the phone to tell Finch, but his voicemail is full. I don't bother texting him. Whenever I write back, it takes him a long time to respond, and when he does, it's never in answer to anything I've said. I'm starting to get mad. 2 days later, Finch writes, "I am on the highest branch." The next morning, "We are written in paint." Later that night, "I believe in signs." The next afternoon, "The glow of ultraviolet." The day after that, "A lake, a prayer. It's so lovely to be lovely in private." And then everything goes quiet. Violet. Violet. April. April 5th is Easter Sunday. My parents and I drive to the A Street Bridge and climb down to the dried-up riverbed that runs below to lay some flowers on the spot where Eleanor was killed. Embedded in the ground is a license plate, one that suddenly looks familiar, and circling this is a small garden where someone has planted flowers. Finch. I go cold all over, not just from the damp air. It's been 1 year, and even though my parents don't say much as we're standing there, we've survived. On the way home, I wonder when Finch was there. When he first found the license plate, when he came back. I wait for my parents to ask about the garden or talk about Eleanor, to call her by name today of all days. When they don't, I say, "It was my idea to see Boy Parade during spring break." Eleanor wasn't crazy about them, but she said, "If you want to see Boy Parade, then let's really see them. Let's follow them all over the Midwest." She was good at that, taking things one step further and making them bigger and more exciting than they would have been. Like someone else I know. I start to sing my favorite Boy Parade song, the one that most reminds me of her. My mom looks at my dad, his eyes fixed on the road, and then she joins in. Back at home, I sit at my desk thinking about my mother's question. Why do I want to start a magazine?
I stare at the board on my wall. My notes are spilling over and across the wall itself and reaching toward the closet. I open the wandering notebook and flip through the pages. On the first empty one I write, Germ. Noun. Pronunciation, germ. The origin of something. A thing that may serve as the basis of further growth or development. I read this over and add, Germ is for everyone. I cross this out. I try again. Germ is meant to entertain, inform, and keep you safe. I cross this out too. I think of Finch and Amanda. And then I look at the closet door where you can still see the thumbtack holes from my calendar. I think of the big black X's that marked off the days because all I wanted was for them to be behind me. I turn to a new page and write, Germ Magazine. You start here. And then I rip it out and add it to my wall. I haven't heard anything from Finch since March. I'm not worried anymore. I'm angry. Angry at him for leaving without a word. Angry at myself for being so easy to leave and for not being enough to make him want to stick around. I do the normal post-breakup things, eating ice cream out of the carton, listening to Better Off Without Him music, choosing a new profile photo for my Facebook page. My bangs are finally growing out, and I'm starting to look like my old self, even if I don't feel like her. On April 8th, I gather the few things I have of his, pack them into a box, and slide them into the back of my closet. No more ultraviolet remarkable. I'm Violet Markey once again. Wherever Finch is, he has our map. On April 10th, I buy another one so that I can finish this project, which I have to do whether he's here or not. Right now, the only things I have are memories of places. Nothing to show for them except a couple of pictures and our notebook. I don't know how to put all of what we've seen and done together into one comprehensive something that will make sense to anyone but me. It, whatever we did and were, doesn't even make sense to me. On April 11th, I borrow Mom's car, and she doesn't ask where I'm going. But as she hands me the keys, she says, Call or text when you get there and when you're on your way home. I head to Crawfordsville, where I make a half-hearted attempt to visit the Rotary Jail Museum, but I feel like a tourist. I call my mother to check in, and afterward I drive. It's a warm Saturday. The sun is bright. It almost feels like spring. And then I remember that technically it is. As I drive, I keep my eye out for a Saturn SUV, and every time I spot one, my heart does this wild leap into my throat, even though I tell myself, I'm done, I'm over him, I'm moving on. I remember what he said about how he loved driving, the forward motion of it, like you might go anywhere. I picture the look on his face if he could see me behind the wheel right now. Ultraviolet, he'd say. I always knew you had it in you. When Ryan and Suze break up, he asks me out. I say yes, but only as friends. On April 17th, we eat dinner at the Gaslight, which is one of the fancier restaurants in Bartlett. I pick at my meal and do my best to focus on Ryan. We talk about college plans and turning 18. His birthday's this month, mine's in May. And while it's not the most exciting conversation I've ever had, it is a nice, normal date with a nice, normal guy. And there's something to be said for that right now. I think about how I've labeled Ryan just like everyone labeled Finch. I suddenly like his solidness and sense of permanence, as if what you see is what you get, and he will always be and do exactly what you expect him to be and do. Except for the stealing, of course. When he walks me to my door, I let him kiss me, and when he calls me the next morning, I answer. On Saturday afternoon, Amanda shows up at my house and asks if I want to hang out. We end up playing tennis in the street, like we did when I first moved here. And afterward, we walk up to the Dairy Queen and order blizzards. That night, we go to the quarry, just Amanda and me. And then I text Brenda and Shelby and Lara and the three Briannas, and they meet us there. An hour later, Jordan Grippenwald and some of the other germ girls have joined us. We dance till it's time to go home. Friday, April 24th, Brenda and I go to the movies, and when she invites me to sleep over, I do. She wants to talk about Finch, but I tell her I'm trying to put him behind me. She hasn't heard from him either, so she lets me be, but not before she says, "Just so you know, it's not you. Whatever reason he had for leaving, it must have been a good one." We stay up till 4 a.m., working on germ. Me on my laptop, Brenda flat on her back on the floor, legs up the wall. She says, "We can help guide our readers into adulthood, like Sherpas on Mount Everest. We give them the truth about sex, the truth about college life, the truth about love." She sighs. "Or at least the truth about what to do when boys are complete and total prats. Do we even know what to do when that happens?" Not at all. I have 15 emails from girls at school wanting to be contributors because Violet Markey, Bell Tower hero and creator of eleanorandviolet.com, Gemma Sterling's favorite blog site, has started another magazine. I read them aloud, and Brenda says, "So, this is what it's like to be popular." By now, she's pretty much my closest friend. Violet, April 26th. On Sunday around 10:30 in the morning, Kate Finch shows up at our door. She looks as if she hasn't slept in weeks. When I invite her in, she shakes her head. "Do you have any idea where Theo might be?" I don't hear from him anymore. She starts nodding. "Okay." She nods and nods. "Okay. Okay, it's just that he's been checking in every Saturday with Mom or me, either by email or voicemail when he knows he won't get us live. I mean, every Saturday. We didn't hear from him yesterday, and then this morning we get this weird email." I try not to feel jealous of the fact that he's been checking in with them, but not me. After all, they're his family. I'm only me, the most important person in his life for a while at least. But okay, I get it. He's moved on. I've moved on too. She hands me a piece of paper. It's the email, sent at 9:43 a.m. "I'm remembering the time we went to Indianapolis to eat at that pizza place. The one with the organ that came up out of the floor. Kate must have been 11. I was 10. Decca was a baby. Mom was there. Dad, too. When the organ started playing so loud the tables shook, the light show started. Remember? It was like the Aurora Borealis. But what stays with me most is all of you. We were happy. We were good. Each and every one of us. The happy times went away for a while, but they're coming back. Mom, 41's not old. Decca, sometimes there's beauty in the tough words. It's all in how you read them. Kate, be careful with your own heart, and remember that you're better than some guy. You're one of the best there is. You all are." I thought you might know why he wrote this, or maybe you might have heard from him. I don't, and I haven't. I'm sorry. I hand her the email and promise to let her know if by some miracle he gets in touch with me, and then she goes away, and I shut the door. I lean against it because for some reason I feel the need to catch my breath. My mom appears, the skin between her eyebrows pinched.
Are you okay?
I almost say, sure, yes, great. But I feel myself folding in two, and I just hug her and rest my head on her shoulder and let her momness surround me for a few minutes. Then I go upstairs and turn on the computer and sign on to Facebook. There's a new message. As of 9:47 a.m., 4 minutes after he sent the email to his family.
The words are written in the waves. If that blue could stay forever, if that hole could remain forever, if this moment could stay forever, I feel myself shining in the dark. I am arrayed. I am prepared. This is the momentary pause, the dark moment. The fiddlers have lifted their bows. This is my calling. This is my world. All is decided and ready. I am rooted, but I flow. Come, I say. Come.
I write the only thing I can think of. Stay, I say. Stay. I check every 5 minutes, but he doesn't reply. I call him again, but the voicemail is still full. I hang up and call Brenda. She answers on the first ring. Hey, I was getting ready to call you. I got this weird email from Finch this morning. Brenda's was sent at 9:41 and said simply,
Some guy will definitely love you for who you are. Don't settle.
The one to Charlie was sent at 9:45 and read,
Peace, you todger.
Something is wrong. I tell myself it's only the heartbreak at being left, the fact that he disappeared without saying goodbye. I pick up the phone to call Kate and realize I don't have her number, so I tell my mom I'll be back and I drive to Finch's house. Kate, Decca, and Mrs. Finch are there. When she sees me, Mrs. Finch starts to cry, and then before I can stop her, she's hugging me too hard and saying, Violet, we're so glad you're here. Maybe you can figure this out. I told Kate maybe Violet will know where he is. Through Mrs. Finch's hair, I look at Kate. Please help me. She says, Mom, and touches her once on the shoulder. Mrs. Finch moves away from me, dabbing at her eyes and apologizing for being so emotional. I ask Kate if I can speak with her alone. She leads me through sliding glass doors outside to the patio where she lights a cigarette. I wonder if this is the same patio where Finch found the cardinal. She frowns at me. What's going on?
He just wrote me. Today. Minutes after the email he sent you. He also sent emails to Brenda Shank Kravitz and Charlie Donahue. I don't want to share his message with her, but I know I have to. I pull out my phone and we stand in the shade of a tree as I show her the lines he wrote.
I didn't even know he was on Facebook, she says, and then goes quiet as she reads. When she's finished, she looks at me, lost.
Okay, what does all that mean?
It's a book we discovered by Virginia Woolf. We've been quoting the lines to each other off and on.
Do you have a copy of the book? Maybe there's a clue in the part that comes before or after this.
I brought it with me. I pull it out of my bag. I've already marked the words, and now I show her where he got them. He's taken them out of sequence, picking and choosing certain lines over a series of pages, and putting them together in his own way, just like his Post-it songs. Kate has forgotten about her cigarette, and the ash dangles as long as a fingernail. I can't figure out what the hell these people are doing. She gestures at the book, much less see how it might relate to where he is. She suddenly remembers her cigarette and takes a long drag. As she exhales, she says,
He's supposed to go to NYU, you know.
Who?
Theo.
She drops the cigarette onto the patio and crushes it with her shoe. He got early acceptance.
NYU. Of course.
What are the odds we were both supposed to be there, but now neither one of us is going? I didn't. He never told me about college.
He didn't tell me or Mom either. The only reason we found out is that someone from NYU tried to contact him during the fall, and I got to the message first.
She forces a smile.
For all I know, he's in New York right now.
Do you know if your mom ever got the messages? The ones from my mom and the psychiatrist?
Deca mentioned the doctor, but Mom almost never checks the home phone. I would have picked up the messages if there were any.
But there weren't.
No.
Because he erased them. We go back inside, and Mrs. Finch is lying on the couch, eyes closed, while Deca sits nearby arranging pieces of paper across the floor. I can't help but watch her because it's so much like Finch and his post-its. Kate notices and says,
"Don't ask me what she's doing. Another one of her art projects."
"Do you mind if I take a look at his room while I'm here?"
"Go for it. We've left everything the way it was, you know, for when he comes back."
If he comes back. Upstairs, I shut the door to his bedroom and stand there a moment. The room still smells like him, a mix of soap and cigarettes and a heady woodsy quality that is distinctly Theodore Finch. I open the windows to let some air in because it's too dead and stale, and then I close them again, afraid the scent of soap and cigarettes and Finch will escape. I wonder if his sisters or Mom have even set foot in this room since he's been gone. It looks so untouched, the drawers still open from when I was here last. I search through the dresser and desk again, and then the bathroom, but there's nothing that can tell me anything. My phone buzzes, and I jump. It's Ryan, and I ignore it. I walk into the closet, where the black light has been replaced by a regular old bulb. I go through the shelves and the remaining clothes, the ones he didn't take with him. I pull his black T-shirt off a hanger and breathe him in, and then I slip it into my purse. I close the door behind me, sit down, and say out loud, "Okay, Finch, help me out here. You must have left something behind." I let myself feel the smallness and closeness of the closet pressing in on me, and I think about Sir Patrick Moore's black hole trick, when he just vanished into thin air. It occurs to me that this is exactly what Finch's closet is, a black hole. He went inside and disappeared. Then I examine the ceiling. I study the night sky he created, but it looks like a night sky and nothing more. I look at our wall of post-its, reading every single one, until I see there is nothing new or added. The short wall, the one opposite the door, holds an empty shoe rack, which he used to hang his guitar from. I sit up and scoot back and check the wall I was leaning against. There are post-its here, too, and for some reason I didn't notice them the last time. Just two lines across, each word on a separate piece of paper. The first reads, "Long last, nothing, time, there, make, was, to, a, him." The second, "Waters, thee, go, to, it, suits, if, thee, there." I reach for the word nothing. I sit cross-legged and hunched over, thinking about the words. I know I've heard them before, though not in this order. I take the words from line one off the wall and start moving them around. "Nothing was to him a long time there make last. Last a long time make there nothing was to him. There was nothing to make him last a long time." On to the second line now. I pluck "go" from the wall and place it first. "To" moves next, and so on until it reads, "Go to the waters, if it suits thee there." By the time I'm back downstairs, it's just Deca and Mrs. Finch. She tells me Kate has gone out to look for Theo, and there's no telling when she'll be back. I have no choice but to talk to Finch's mom. I ask if she'd mind coming upstairs. She climbs the steps like a much older person, and I wait for her at the top. She hesitates on the landing.
What is it, Violet?
I don't think I can handle surprises.
It's a clue to where he is. She follows me into his room and stands for a moment, looking around as if she's seeing it for the first time.
When did he paint everything blue?
Instead of answering, I point at the closet. In here. We stand in his closet, and she covers her mouth at how bare it is, how much is gone. I crouch in front of the wall and show her the post-its. She says,
"That first line. That's what he said after the cardinal died.
I think he's gone back to one of the places we wandered. One of the places with water."
"The words are written in the waves,"
he wrote on Facebook, at 9:47 a.m., the same time as the Jovian Plutonian hoax. The water could be the Bloomington Empire Quarry, or the Seven Pillars, or the river that runs in front of the high school, or about 100 other places. Mrs. Finch stares blankly at the wall, and it's hard to know if she's even listening. "I can give you directions and tell you exactly where to look for him. There are a couple of places he could have gone, but I have a pretty good idea where he might be." Then she turns to me and lays her hand on my arm and squeezes it so hard I can almost feel the bruise forming.
"I hate to ask you, but can you go? I'm just so worried, and I don't think I could. I mean, in case something were to, or if he were..."
She is crying again, the hard and ugly kind, and I'm ready to promise her anything as long as she stops.
"I just really need you to bring him home."
Violet, April 26th, Part 2. I don't go for her or for his dad, or for Kate, or for Decca. I go for me. Maybe because I know, somehow, what I'll find. And maybe because I know whatever I find will be my fault. After all, it's because of me he had to leave his closet. I was the one who pushed him out by talking to my parents and betraying his trust. He never would have left if it hadn't been for me. Besides, I tell myself, Finch would want me to be the one to come. I call my parents to tell them I'll be home in a while, that I've got something to do, and then I hang up on my dad even as he's asking me a question and drive. I drive faster than I normally do, and I remember the way without looking at the map. I am scarily, eerily calm, as if someone else is doing the driving. I keep the music off. This is how focused I am on getting there. If that blue could stay forever, if that hole could remain forever. There was nothing to make him last. The first thing I see is Little Bastard, parked on the side of the road. Right wheels front and back on the embankment. I pull up behind it and turn off the engine. I sit there. I can drive away right now. If I drive away, Theodore Finch is still somewhere in the world, living and wandering, even if it's without me. My fingers are on the ignition key. Drive away. I get out of the car, and the sun is too warm for April in Indiana. The sky is blue after nothing but gray for the past few months, except for that first warm day. I leave my jacket behind. I walk past the no trespassing signs and the house that sits off the road and up a driveway. I climb up the embankment and go down the hill to the wide round pool of blue water ringed by trees. I don't know how I didn't notice it the first time. The water is as blue as his eyes. The place is deserted and peaceful. So deserted and peaceful that I almost turn around and go back to the car. But then I see them. His clothes on the bank. Folded neatly and stacked. Collared shirt on top of jeans, on top of leather jacket, on top of black boots. It's like a greatest hits of his closet. Only there, on the bank. For a long time I don't move. Because if I stand here like this, Finch is still somewhere. Then, I kneel beside the stack of clothes and lay my hand on them, as if by doing so I can learn where he is and how long ago he came. The clothes are warm from the sun. I find his phone tucked into one of the boots, but it's completely dead. In the other boot, his nerd glasses and car keys. Inside the leather jacket, I find our map, folded as neatly as the clothes. Without thinking, I put it in my bag. "Marco," I whisper. Then, I stand. "Marco," I say louder. I pull off my shoes and coat and set my keys and phone beside the neat stack of Finch's clothing. I climb onto the rock ledge and dive into the water, and it knocks the breath out of me because it's cold, not warm. I tread circles head up until I can breathe, and then I take a breath and go under, where the water is strangely clear. I go as deep as I can, heading straight for the bottom. The water feels darker the deeper I go, and too soon I have to push up to the surface and fill my lungs. I dive again and again, going as deep as I dare before running out of breath. I swim from one end of the hold to the other, back and forth. I come up and then go down again. Each time I can stay a little longer, but not as long as Finch, who can hold his breath for minutes. Could hold. Because at some point, I know. He's gone. He's not somewhere. He's nowhere. Even after I know, I dive and swim and dive and swim, up and down and back and forth until finally, when I can't do it anymore, I crawl up onto the bank, exhausted, lungs heaving, hands shaking. As I dial 911, I think, he's not nowhere. He's not dead. He just found that other world. The sheriff for Vigo County arrives with the fire department and an ambulance. I sit on the bank wrapped in a blanket someone has given me, and I think about Finch and Sir Patrick Moore and black holes and blue holes and bottomless bodies of water and exploding stars and event horizons and a place so dark that light can't get out once it's in. Now these strangers are here and milling around. And they must be the ones who own this property and this house. They have children, and the woman is covering their eyes and shooing them away, telling them to get on back in there and don't come out, whatever you do, not till she says so. Her husband says, "Goddamn kids," and he doesn't mean his. He means kids in general, kids like Finch and me. Men are diving over and over. Three or four of them. They all look the same. I want to tell them not to bother. They're not going to find anything. He's not there. If anyone can make it to another world, it's Theodore Finch. Even when they bring the body up, swollen and bloated and blue, I think, that's not him. That's someone else. This swollen, bloated, blue thing with the dead, dead skin is not anyone I know or recognize. I tell them so. They ask me if I feel strong enough to identify him, and I say, "That's not him. That is a swollen, bloated, dead, dead blue thing, and I can't identify it because I've never seen it before." I turn my head away. The sheriff crouches down beside me. "We're going to need to call his parents." He is asking for the number, but I say, "I'll do it. She was the one who asked me to come.
She wanted me to find him. I'll call.
But that's not him. Don't you see? People like Theodore Finch don't die. He's just wandering.
I call the line his family never uses. His mother answers on the first ring as if she's been sitting right there waiting. For some reason, this makes me mad, and I want to slam the phone off and throw it into the water.
Hello?
She says.
Hello?
There's something shrill and hopeful and terrified in her voice.
Oh, God, hello?
Mrs. Finch? It's Violet. I found him. He was where I thought he would be. I'm so sorry. My voice sounds as if it's underwater or coming from the next county. I am pinching the inside of my arm, making little red marks because I suddenly can't feel anything. His mother lets out a sound I've never heard before, low and guttural and terrible. Once again, I want to throw the phone into the water so it will stop, but instead I keep saying, I'm sorry, over and over and over, like a recording, until the sheriff pries the phone from my hand. As he talks, I lie back against the ground, the blanket wrapped around me, and say to the sky, May your eye go to the sun, to the wind your soul. You are all the colors in one. At full brightness. Violet. May 3rd. I stand in front of the mirror and study my face. I am dressed in black. Black skirt, black sandals, and Finch's black t-shirt, which I've belted. My face looks like my face, only different. It is not the face of a carefree teenage girl who has been accepted at 4 colleges and has good parents and good friends and her whole life ahead of her. It is the face of a sad, lonely girl something bad has happened to. I wonder if my face will ever look the same again, or if I'll always see it in my reflection. Finch. Eleanor. Loss. Heartache. Guilt. Death. But will other people be able to tell? I take a picture with my phone, fake smiling as I pose, and when I look at it, there's Violet Markey. I could post it on Facebook right now, and no one would know that I took it after instead of before. My parents want to go with me to the funeral, but I say no. They are hovering too much and watching me. Every time I turn around, I see their worried eyes and the looks they give each other. And there's something else. Anger. They are no longer mad at me because they're furious with Mrs. Finch, and probably Finch too, although they haven't said so. My dad, as usual, is more outspoken than my mom, and I overhear him talking about that woman and how he'd like to give her a piece of his goddamn mind before Mom shushes him and says, Violet might hear you. His family stands in the front row, and it is raining. This is the first time I've seen his dad, who is tall and broad-shouldered and movie star handsome. The mousy woman who must be Finch's stepmom stands next to him, her arm around a very small boy. Next to him is Decca, and then Kate, and then Mrs. Finch. Everyone is crying, even the dad. Golden Acres is the largest cemetery in town. We stand at the top of a hill next to the casket. My second funeral in just over a year's time, even though Finch wanted to be cremated. The preacher is quoting verses from the Bible, and the family is weeping and everyone is weeping, even Amanda Monk and some of the cheerleaders. Ryan and Romer are there, and about 200 other kids from school. I also recognize Principal Wirtz and Mr. Black and Mrs. Kresney and Mr. Embry from the counseling office. I stand off to the side with my parents, who insisted on coming,
and Brenda and Charlie. Brenda's mom is there, her hand resting on her daughter's shoulder. Charlie is standing with his hands folded in front of him, staring at the casket. Brenda is staring at Romer and the rest of the crying herd, her eyes dry and angry. I know what she's feeling. Here are these people who called him freak and never paid attention to him except to make fun of him or spread rumors about him, and now they are carrying on like professional mourners, the ones you can hire in Taiwan or the Middle East to sing, cry, and crawl on the ground. His family is just as bad. After the preacher is finished, everyone moves toward them to shake their hands and offer condolences. The family accepts them as if they've earned them. No one says anything to me. And so I stand quietly in Finch's black t-shirt, thinking. In all his words, the preacher doesn't mention suicide. The family is calling his death an accident because they didn't find a proper note, and so the preacher talks about the tragedy of someone dying so young, of a life ended too soon, of possibilities never realized. I stand thinking how it wasn't an accident at all, and how suicide victim is an interesting term. The victim part of it implies they had no choice. And maybe Finch didn't feel like he had a choice, or maybe he wasn't trying to kill himself at all, but just going in search of the bottom. But I'll never really know, will I? Then I think, you can't do this to me. You were the one who lectured me about living. You were the one who said I had to get out and see what was right in front of me and make the most of it and not wish my time away and find my mountain because my mountain was waiting, and all that adds up to life. But then you leave. You can't just do that, especially when you know what I went through losing Eleanor. I try to remember the last words I said to him, but I can't. Only that they were angry and normal and unremarkable. What would I have said to him if I'd known I would never see him again? As everyone begins to break apart and walk away, Ryan finds me to say,
I'll call you later.
It's a question, so I answer it with a nod. He nods back, and then he's gone. Charlie mutters,
what a bunch of phonies.
And I'm not sure if he's talking about our classmates, or the Finch family, or the entire congregation. Bren's voice is brittle. Somewhere, Finch is watching this, all, what do you expect? I hope he's flipping them off. Mr. Finch was the one to officially ID the body. The paper reported that by the time Finch was found, he'd probably been dead several hours. I say, do you really think he's somewhere? Brenda blinks at me. Like, anywhere. I mean, I like to think wherever he is, maybe he can't see us because he's alive and in some other world better than this. The kind of world he would have designed if he could have. I'd like to live in a world designed by Theodore Finch, I think. For a while, I did. Before Brenda can answer, Finch's mother is suddenly beside me, red eyes peering into my face. She sweeps me into a hug and holds on like she never plans to let go.
Oh, Violet, she cries. Oh, dear girl, are you okay?
I pat her like you would pat a child, and then Mr. Finch is there, and he is hugging me with his big arms, his chin on my head. I can't breathe. And then I feel someone pulling me away, and my father says, I think we'll take her home. His voice is curt and cold. I let myself be led to the car. At home, I picket my dinner and listen to my parents talk about the Finches and controlled, even voices that have been carefully chosen so as not to upset me. Dad,
I wish I could have given those people a piece of my mind today.
Mom, she had no right to ask Violet to do that. She glances at me and says too brightly, Do you need more vegetables, honey? Me. No, thank you. Before they can start in on Finch and the selfishness of suicide and the fact that he took his life when Eleanor had hers taken from her when she didn't get a say in the matter, such a wasteful, hateful, stupid thing to do, I ask to be excused, even though I've barely touched my food. I don't have to help with the dishes, so I go upstairs and sit in my closet. My calendar is shoved into a corner. I unfold it now, smoothing it out, and look at all the blank days, too many to count, that I didn't mark off because these were the days I had with Finch. I think, I hate you. If only I'd known. If only I'd been enough. I let you down. I wish I could have done something. I should have done something. Was it my fault? Why wasn't I enough? Come back. I love you. I'm sorry. Violet. May, weeks 1, 2, and 3. At school, the entire student body seems to be in mourning. There is a lot of black being worn, and you can hear sniffling in every classroom. Someone has built a shrine to Finch in one of the large glass cases in the main hallway near the principal's office. His school picture has been blown up, and they have left the case open so that we can all post tributes around it. Dear Finch, they all begin, you are loved and missed. We love you. We miss you. I want to tear them all down and shred them up and put them in the pile with the rest of the bad, false words, because that's exactly where they belong. Our teachers remind us that there are just 5 more weeks of school, and I should be happy, but instead, I feel nothing. I feel a lot of nothing these days. I've cried a few times, but mostly, I'm empty, as if whatever makes me feel and hurt and laugh and love has been surgically removed, leaving me hollowed out like a shell. I tell Ryan we can only ever be friends, and it's just as well because he doesn't want to touch me. No one does. It's like they're afraid I might be contagious. This is part of the suicide by association phenomenon. I sit with Brenda, Lara, and the Briannas at lunch until the Wednesday after Finch's funeral when Amanda walks over, sets her tray down, and without looking at the other girls says to me, I'm sorry about Finch. For a minute, I think Brenda is going to hit her, and I kind of want her to, or at least I want to see what would happen if she did. But when Bren just sits there, I nod at Amanda. Thanks. I shouldn't have called him a freak. And I want you to know I broke up with Romer.
Too little, too late, Brenda mutters.
She stands suddenly, knocking into the table, making everything rattle. She grabs her tray, tells me she'll see me later, and marches off. On Thursday, I meet with Mr. Embry because Principal Wirtz and the school board are requiring all friends and classmates of Theodore Finch to have at least one session with a counselor, even though the parents, as my mother and father refer to Mr. Finch and Mrs. Finch, are insisting it was an accident, which I guess means we are free to mourn him out in the open in a normal, healthy, unstigmatized way. No need to be ashamed or embarrassed since suicide isn't involved. I ask for Mr. Embry instead of Mrs. Kresny because he was Finch's counselor. From behind his desk, he frowns at me, and I suddenly wonder if he's going to blame me like I blame myself. I should never have suggested we take the A Street Bridge. What if we'd gone the other way instead? Eleanor would still be here. Mr. Embry clears his throat.
I'm sorry about Finch. He was a good, screwed-up kid who should have had more help.
This gets my attention. Then he adds,
I feel responsible.